Hello, everyone, and welcome to NWR Connectivity, episode 342. I'm your host, John Raridan, joined, as usual, by Neil Ronahan.
Hey, everybody.
Howdy. And our extra special guest for this week, joining us from the distant land of Canada, Jordan Rudek.
The only reason, well, one of the main reasons I come on is to be referred to as extra special. I sometimes need that.
You're always extra special.
Appreciate that, John.
But the real reason that Jordan is extra special is not because of anything about him personally. It's just because he played a game we want to hear about. By the time you're listening to this, Rabbids will be out. In fact, it will have been out for a day.
My copy is arriving tomorrow. I'm excited.
Good, because that's when it comes out. So that's when it should arrive. But yeah, Jordan is special because he played Rabbids like a while ago. It's old news for him. Jordan, how do you feel about Rabbids?
So, I'll do the whole story thing in a minute. But yeah, Rabbids is really good. I think it's better than the first one. I really enjoyed the first one. If you're looking for like a really overwhelming story and, you know, a deeply compelling narrative, you're not going to find that. But the gameplay has improved in pretty much every way. I think there's a ton of extra stuff to do in each world. The character interactions are fine. They're fun. I think Rabbid Mario is hilarious, actually. And I think adding the voice to him specifically does make it better.
Wait. Does he like talk?
A little bit, like just a few words. Like they don't do entire lines, but just a like.
Wait, what does Rabbid Mario say?
Okay, so he says like really stupid. So whenever he does a team jump, which is just kind of jumping on one of your teammates to get a boost, and then you can float around and get to a distant point on the map. He says something like, I'm a jump. I laugh every single time.
Is that the Chris Pratt Mario voice?
Man. It would be amazing if Chris Pratt played Rabbid Mario.
Give me DLC for this game where Chris Pratt does the voice of a character. It's just him doing different Bob's Burgers characters for every member.
Turns out he's a really good Bob's Burger impersonator.
He's just a big fan. He likes Lauren Bouchard.
It must have been in the script, like, this is what the character is supposed to sound like, and he just nails it, right? Mm-hmm. Sparks of Hope is really good. I did an interview with David Soliani, the creative director. I'm gonna try to publish that tomorrow. Actually, I'm gonna see if I can transcribe that tonight and throw it on Nintendo World Report tomorrow. So hopefully that will be posted by the time you're listening to this as well. But yeah, no, the game itself is really good. Finished it, posted the review, gave it a 9. I don't have many qualms with it. Like I had a really fun time playing it. Very hard to put down. It's not super long. I mean, if anyone knows me at all, they know how, especially you two fine gentlemen, you know how fast I finish games.
Can I guess?
Yeah,
15
please,
hours.
Please.
15 hours to completion.
Higher. So when I rolled credits, a little higher than 15.
20.
Just over 18.
Okay. You know, it's funny. I was waiting to see what you said because I did see, like, I saw like a tweet online where someone's like, it took me 45 hours to reach the end. And I'm like, I guarantee you, Jordan did it in half that time.
that's laughable to me. I'm like, you would have to like run around in circles, just not know where to go. And there's always like an indicator on your mini map of where to go. So, yeah. I mean, if you were maybe doing everything to 100% of the game, yeah, I could see in the 30 to 40 range for sure. But I got 78% completion at 18 hours. I do play the games very fast. I'm not experimenting a ton. I did experiment. The game does force you to experiment. There are certain battles, and a lot of the battles are considered side quests because they grant you like a collectible coin that you can spend on special items and stuff, and weapon skins and things like that. There are certain battles where it forces you to use a maximum of two characters, and they are handpicked for that fight. For example, playing with like Peach and Rabbid Peach, or Luigi and Bowser, or something like that. And those are pretty fun because you don't have the luxury of characters you're familiar with. And the fact is, most of the time you're playing with three characters, which is the party size after about halfway through the first world. So it throws a lot of different things at you. Some battles you have to just survive like 3 to 6 turns, or you have to get to a specific space on the map. I think that's returning from Kingdom Battle. But it's a really fun game. I don't know how you don't just enjoy playing this game. Like I don't know what someone would want. Even if you've never played a strategy game before, it does a really good job of introducing you to that genre. Maybe an even better introduction than the first game. But if you've played the first game and like that, you're going to love this one. Like that's the bottom line.
I mean, that's the vibe that I get. And it is. So I went back to the first game because it was a game in which the save file was one of the things that I lost when my Switch died.
Okay.
And I wanted to, I never played the Donkey Kong DLC. So I went back to it, and that first world was a lot harder because it's, I think the original game, it is such an inventive and wild idea, but given some time, it's a little bit rigid. Like the one thing that I really hope for Sparks of Hope is that it's just more confident, because you could tell with the original that they're like, oh, what are people going to like? What if they hate this? Whereas with Sparks of Hope, I mean, like the reaction to the first Mario Rabbids games is pretty much like across the board success. Yeah. Like everybody, I mean, like I guarantee you there are people that just hate that game for some reason. But like generally speaking, like it sold well, critically acclaimed, fans like it. Like it's a very good game.
And it seems the same with Sparks of Hope, that across the board, like the critical reception is very positive. You know, we're talking about like 85 or higher on Metacritic, kind of in the same territory as the first game. But I mean, obviously with the sequel, expectations are higher. You know, like you don't expect just the same thing.
It's been 5 years.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
But I guess with that is that like, it feels like a really like amorphous thing to ask, but does this second game feel confident?
Yeah, and I think you notice that in the way that they give you freedom. Right. If they weren't confident, you wouldn't have the freedom to do certain things.
It wouldn't just be like each world was a straight line that you would find some coins.
They would force you along a critical path or a linear path because, you know, they don't know what players are going to do. Are they going to get lost? Are they going to get stuck? Are they going to encounter battles that are too hard? Everything in this game, you know, kind of what you're in for, I suppose. Like if you are standing outside a potential battle, you see the recommended level for your characters, right? And if you're wildly below that, if you're 3 or 4 levels below that, you know, it's going to be incredibly hard to win that fight. You might be able to do it, but it's not going to be, it's certainly not, you're not ready for that technically. And a lot of players won't be ready for that yet. But you come back later, you gain a few levels, maybe pick up a new character or pick up some new sparks to equip to your characters, and then maybe you'd be set for that new fight. But yeah, the planets themselves have a lot of exploration that you can do, whether that's completing little puzzles, collecting coins, star bits, completing side quests, which aren't always in the form of battles. Sometimes they're just, yeah, discovering something secret, like a treasure chest, or using your Beepo powers. Beepo is the kind of robotic Roomba thing that follows you around. not a high point of the game. And I know some people found his voice grating as well, but whatever. He gains like these special exploration powers that allow you to create platforms or to scan for things that aren't visible in the environment. And so using some of the machine's powers allow you to find side quests and find hidden things as well. So you are rewarded for exploring. That everything is kind of tracked, like your percentage of how much you've done in the world for each planet is tracked. And so you kind of know how much there is to do, or if you need to come back later to do something. One of the examples of that is that there are certain fights that are gated off by the number of sparks you own. And these fights are generally against like larger than life enemies, like a giant Goomba or something like that. And those are tougher than almost any of the boss fights, actually. So you do want to kind of come back to those later after you've leveled up a bit, you know, found some better sparks, and the sparks themselves can level up too. So there's a lot of little things that just click and work really well here.
So the exploration, which I mean, like talked about the combat a little bit and just in how it's a little bit more expanded and going along with the side quests, some of the vibe that I've gotten from hearing people talk about this is it almost feels like it's a Ubisoft open world game. Like how much does it feel like it's in that vein, or does it strike something where it doesn't feel like low key derivative?
Yeah, I mean, a Ubisoft open world game. The last one I played was Assassin's Creed Valhalla, and it's a good game. There's just too much. There's just way too much to do. I think those games are too open, and I get it. They're like a paradise or a playground for people who have 80 to 200 hours to sink into those games, and like that maybe that's their one game for 3 months. But for us, you know, we're constantly playing new games, finishing them as quickly as we can to get to the next one, or especially when you get to like the fall season. And it's just every week has a major release that you want to play. Like, I think this game respects your time in that way. Like, you again, you can finish it in 20 to 25 hours. If you want to do a little bit more, it's there for you. And I don't even think there's a ton more. I think we know that there's DLC coming for this game. They're going to add some content, add another planet, add some new characters. We know that Rayman is coming in the third DLC pack. I think they've created something that on its own is a nice, tidy, finished package, and will add to it with hopefully some meaningful content down the road. Like they did with the first game, right? The DLC with the Donkey Kong Adventure, that was really fun. And it changes up the gameplay in a noticeable and exciting way. I hope that will be the case with whatever they add on here. But the base game is good enough, and it's not... It may have taken some lessons learned from Ubisoft open world games, but it's not daunting or unruly like some of those are.
Yeah, like I've enjoyed, like, I guess, what was it, Origins or Odyssey was the kind of the new vibe of Assassin's Creed.
Yeah, I think it started with Origins. Yeah.
Like I played Origins and was like, this is great, and then I started Odyssey and I was like, I have a life and too a much, life and much. Children and a job. Yeah, I need to take a break. Yep. And I think those are very good, and I think there's a lot that you can learn from them. And I think that looking at a lot of open world games like Breath of the Wild or Assassin's Creed Odyssey, like there's a lot to learn from them. And I'm glad that Mario & Rabbids isn't taking that to the nth degree.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. You don't show up on any of the worlds and think, I have no idea, I can go in any direction, do anything. They're not that big. There's a lot of little things to do, but the little things don't take up so much of your time. Even the battles are quite... Well, they're quick. They're well paced. You know, a battle's not going to take you more than, at least a side quest battle is probably not more than 5 minutes. You know, like we're talking like three to four minutes per battle. The boss fights take longer and often involve multiple stages to them, or multiple sections or segments. But yeah, most of the game just goes at this really quick, breezy pace. I think that's what makes it really hard to put down. Like you might say just one more fight, but one more fight doesn't take you that long. You know, I just want to see the next part of the main story. The way the main story works is it kind of has different quest parts to it. So you do one quest part, maybe that's meeting like a certain rabid citizen on the planet, and then they need to find somebody, or they need to fix a broken bridge, or fix a windmill that's been taken over by this dark mess substance. And then you do that, and then they give you something else to do. There's kind of two main story quests along the story for each planet, and the whole way that it's structured again just lends itself to being accessible to a wide audience, but also just fun to play in bursts, but also hard to put down. Like it's just a good gameplay is king, and that's kind of the thing I would take away from this game. Like it's just a incredibly fun game.
Will I miss any key story beats if I didn't finish the first one before playing this?
I don't think they're connected really at all.
Okay, cool.
I mean, there may be something that I just didn't notice in kind of rushing through the game a little bit. There may be a few different offhand remarks or something, but nothing noticeable, nothing substantial. Again, aside from Beepo carrying over and the fact that they don't need to reintroduce the rabbit characters. They're kind of just part of the group, you know, because they were already part of the group. That's it. You know, it's more like just a new story, but there's not a lot of backtracking or connecting, but connective tissue.
Good. Cause I want to play this, but I feel like at this point I'd have to start Kingdom Battle over from scratch if I wanted to actually finish it. And I don't want to do that.
Don't feel like you have to go back. In fact, it might be a fun experiment to play this first and then go back and see, like, you'd probably appreciate Sparks of Hope more, I think, especially what it allows you to do in combat. One thing I'll spoil about the interview I did with David is he said that it's less a sequel to Kingdom Battle and more of an iteration on the Donkey Kong Adventure DLC. So,
oh, interesting.
I thought that was interesting too. And I guess it's the way that they play around with the composition of characters in combat with that one. I think that they really work well together in tandem. And here, it's so much about, you know, the characters you choose, their special abilities, and then the sparks you equip to them. So you make these parties that synergize really, really well. And then when it all kind of comes to fruition in the combat, like, it's just really, really satisfying.
I need them to lay out the Mario and Rabbids timeline that I know where this takes place. Is this in the Mario is Dead timeline? These are all crucial.
Mario is dead and Rabid Mario has taken his place. And so,
yes,
the third game will revolve around him, I suppose.
That is probably the end goal, is eventually Ubisoft can just drop the Mario characters and just make Rabbids Kingdom Battle and not have to pay those pesky licensing fees.
Yeah, no, but I mean, just to put a fine point on it, like people should buy this game. Like it's another high quality thing. Like we were all kind of shocked by the first game being so good. There shouldn't be any shock. The people making these games know what they're doing, and they've only improved upon the original product.
Good. Neil, you have also been playing a game.
Is it good?
Yeah,
I mean, it's way less of a big deal than Mario & Rabbids, but it's a game that it's a weird bug catching game called Paradise Marsh. It came out, I believe it's a singular developer. It came out last week. What stood out to me was that one, it's got like cool, like lo-fi 3D visuals. And also the soundtrack is by Disasterpiece, who has done the Fez soundtrack. I believe, did he do Hyperlight? I think he did Hyperlight Drifter too. And also like the movie It Follows. But like very good stuff from Disasterpiece. So that definitely perked me up. And I was like, I'll check this game out. And at first, I kind of wasn't into it as much. But then I played a little bit more. And essentially what the game is you're wandering around a relatively small set of biomes that are stitched together looking for bugs to catch. And I mean, like, yeah, I guess it's like, you know, there's frogs, there's moths, there's spiders, there's like your horned beetles and things like that. Tadpoles even are the kind of things you can catch with your fancy bug net. But your whole goal is to just like catch these different bugs and then you catch enough of them and then you can make a constellation in the sky. And there's a lot of like weird poems that you can find too. And like all of the bugs, when you put them up when you get the constellation, put them up in the sky, they're like, damn it. Like now I'm stuck here again. Like this is fun, but like what the hell? There might be some kind of payoff at the end of getting all the bugs in the sky, which honestly, I want to find out. It does not seem like it is a terribly long game, probably a few hours at the very most, but it's got very good vibes about it. And like the visuals are fun. There's a lot of like, I mean, it seems like intentional pop-in just because it is a lo-fi like N64-ish looking game. Reminds me of like the visuals of Frogun, that game that came out over the summer that I believe
Jordan reviewed. Yeah, I thought it almost looked a little bit like a Short Hike or something like that.
Yeah, I got that sense too.
I think if I had a knock against it, or could at least see a knock against it, is that the game explains like virtually nothing, which did lead me in like my first like half an hour of the game. I was like, oh no, I think this sucks. I thought the game was going to be way more complex than it is. And so I was like, oh God, like I'm going to need to like figure out how to like get these different bugs to come out and what the heck, there's all these bugs to collect. But it is a lot more of like, I don't know, just like wander around, look for a spider and catch the spider. And then like find some tadpoles. There might be some kind of payoff at the end. And that will likely be reflected in my eventual review that I write for this game. But so far, so interesting.
Cool.
And then other than that, I'll just give a brief Xenoblade 3 update.
Sure.
In my leisurely distracted playthrough, I have crossed the 60-hour mark. I'm in chapter 6. Holy shit, the end of chapter 5 into chapter 6. And I'm just doing a bunch of hero quests. I got the deal. Oh, did you guys play any of the DLC stuff with Xenoblade 3?
I got all my swimsuits. Because if Tion isn't showing chest, are you really even playing the game?
Well, I only have the first round of swimsuits because I think most of the second round I need to like beat the game in order to get those.
I think the second round are just alternate colors.
Okay.
So I think they're the same.
That's a little disappointing.
I haven't actually checked. But that's how it was in Xenoblade 2.
That means Lance has not shown off them guns.
No.
Or I guess those pecs. And I'm disappointed.
Listen, he's like, just because he's muscular doesn't mean he's confident, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I do. It is the kind of thing that like, and it's like, maybe it's stretching the fact that, I mean, I think the swimsuits are just like, it's kind of funny.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe there's in certain eyes, maybe it's not funny and it's disgusting. But to me, it's kind of funny. And I do like that you look at the swimsuits that they have for each character. And I could definitely like very easily be like, this is why this character is wearing this kind of swimsuit.
Oh, there's so much thought put into
it. Yeah. Like, that's the part of it that I really like, is that, like, yes, of course Noah would not give a shit and just bare chest.
I feel like everybody's swimsuit makes sense except for Tyon's just, like, deep navel level V. Where that's, like, somebody in the art department just was just fashion, thirsty, man. For Tyon. Yeah, that's where that ends. But yeah, I did that. I haven't gotten the new hero for it, because I was actually, when I got distracted and stopped playing, I was finishing up the last of the base game hero quests. So I actually just got around to finishing out the full base game roster.
Yeah, I think that the new hero, I think the actual design of the character, as far as like getting the like HD ether in order to, you know, level up abilities and things, like, I kind of like that. However, mm-hmm. that character who's like an artificial blade that speaks like a Nopon can fuck right off.
Listen, had to bring Poppy back.
Yeah, basically, it's just bringing Poppy back.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to see like what the other DLC character will be as well. I'm still like, man, I adore this game. Like, I think part of the reason why I don't really want it to end.
I have so many Ascension quests that I'm not doing for exactly that reason. Of like, yeah. Once I do them, they'll be gone. So I need them to just stay there in my quest log.
I think I have
log.
Every hero I can have at this point in the story. And I think I've done 5 Ascension quests.
Yeah.
But like, I mean, like, it's just really good.
Yeah.
Like, across the, like, wow. Like, continually yep. impressed and surprised at how excellent this game is.
Yep. It is good.
I know that feeling well of playing an RPG and loving it so much that you don't want it to end. And so you just kind of, you do everything you can. You wander around aimlessly. You try to fill out like every portion of every map. And yeah, like I envy you being in that spot right now with the game, Neil, because man, it's such a kind of a honeymoon phase to be in with the game, I guess. You're just so in love. It just never wanted to
yeah.
be over.
And I am just gearing up for the ending that
yeah.
that John
I was
did not
gonna
like.
Say I also wish that I could be back at chapter 6 yeah, and yeah. not chapter 7.
It does yeah. seem like it's a little bit all downhill from here, because like just like, oh man, all that stuff landed so well.
You have reached I'll just say I feel like if we pretend that these games are produced completely linearly, like they start at the beginning of the game and just make it from the beginning to the end, then I feel like you're at the point where they ran out of time and money. You are entering yeah. disc 2 of Xenogears.
what was it, March or April, when Nintendo was like, guess what? You guys are coming out 2 months
yeah,
earlier.
This chapter, a little bit of 6 and all of 7 were what they were going to use those other 2 months on. That's what happened.
But yeah, I think I am at the point where like I'm clearing out the list of Ascension quests that I have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when I do that, then I'll probably, as opposed to seeking more out, which, I mean, it could happen. But I think I might go ahead with the story a little bit more.
Yeah. We can't complain that Xenoblade got moved up and Splatoon pushed back, because all that extra time on Splatoon allowed them to iron out the online kinks, right?
So oh, yeah, it's
totally
really,
worth it.
Splatoon 3 shows just so much polish. And refinement, a shining jewel of the library.
Sure. Yeah. I must say, like, the lobby's really cool. It provides a nice way for me to get disconnected from a multiplayer game.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, wouldn't you? I mean, if you're going to get booted out back to somewhere, wouldn't you like it to be somewhere nice?
Yeah. Somewhere nice where all of the ink that I laid down got reset, as then I have to go wait to get into another lobby.
In theory, you won't get disconnected if you just walk around the hub area, right? Like, you can just talk to people.
You can't yeah. get disconnected if you never play.
That's true too. Yeah.
Speaking of not playing Splatoon 3, what I have been playing is a game called One True Hero, which is an indie 3D Zelda meets 3D platformer game, which is like 100% my thing. It reminds me a lot of A Knight's Quest, which was another like not amazing but pretty cool indie Zelda like 3D platformer game. And One True Hero is very goofy, extremely tongue-in-cheek, has lots of references to Zelda, has really solid character animations. Like, every cutscene is just delightful to watch. The art is kind of questionable and feels very low budget and cobbled together from somewhat generic looking assets. But like there's a lot of heart there in the presentation. Unfortunately, it's also like one of the buggiest games I've played in a very, very, very long time. It's the first game in a while where I've encountered bugs so bad that as I exploit the bugs more and more, I get nervous that it's going to autosave me in a bugged state, because that happened once and it was very hard to then get out of that bugged state every time I reloaded. I had one repeatable bug where I could fall off the map in a certain way where I would respawn as a dead body with a moon jump. So I would just be a limp corpse that could fly, and I could just go anywhere I wanted in the map, which
sounds
was
like
exciting.
A cheat code rather than a bug.
Right. And I was doing it for a while, but then it would like, I was scared that it was going to autosave me like somewhere where I wouldn't be able to get back. But yeah. And the whole game is just, I'm constantly fighting little bugs and like random pieces of the world that don't have collision. And so I'm walking through things, and it's just a bummer. Because, like, you can clearly see that there's, like, a really cool game in there. But, hoo boy, is it just not done. So, I suppose developer of One True Hero, I don't remember who you are, but if you're listening to this, I'm very interested in playing the final version of your game. I think it could be really cool. This version should probably not have been sold. Maybe it's better on other platforms. I don't know. I will say what's funny is that it looks really sharp. Like resolution is great and it runs. I haven't frame rate tested it, but I think it might be 60 frames per second and like runs really smoothly. So it's like a really well optimized buggy game, which is a weird combo, but yeah, a lot of potential. Hopefully it'll get very significant patches, but maybe steer clear for now. I'll have a review of that on some point. I hit a point where I'm progressing again now, but I had a while in there where I was actually having trouble making progress because of a particularly thick layer of bugs that I was trying to get through in one area. But yeah, so look forward to that at some point.
So long story short, this isn't the combination of Last Action Hero and True Lies we were promised.
Not quite. Mm. Not, you know, it doesn't live up to that level of hype.
I mean, who
one could say.
Know,
right. You know, it's a high bar.
Two Arnold masterpieces right there.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's
asking a lot.
You know what might live up to that is the game that Jordan's been playing.
It's
I
very
don't actually
good game.
Know. Yes, I just perfect. Know it's good. I haven't played it.
It rocks so hard.
I've heard the soundtrack.
The soundtrack is incredible. Really
too. Neil, can you give me some... When did this game come out? I believe you reviewed it.
It was a
site.
Mobile game. It was a
we
mobile game.
We should introduce
game.
What the game is.
Dicey Dungeons. It is a game from Terry Cavanaugh, who, I guess if you're a 3DS player of a certain era, Terry Cavanaugh also made VVV, VVV, and Super Hexagon. But Dicey Dungeons, I remember, I think it was at, there was a demo of it at like a PAX South. It was on PC first, I think. I forget because the mobile version came out this year. The Switch version came out at the end of 2021.
Yeah.
It was mentioned in an indie world. And it was something like when I was like, oh, it's coming to Switch. Because I remember playing the demo at a PAX South and was like, sweet, when this comes to Switch, I'm going to play the crap out of it. And it essentially shadow dropped. I think, or it was, but it was like mid-December. So we didn't even get a review copy or anything. I just wound up buying it. And then like I think it was the end of this year. You know what? I actually want to double check because I think it might've been the end of 2020 and the year.
What is
just,
time?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It was the end of 2020.
End of 2020. Yeah. Jeez.
Yeah.
2 years almost.
And really it was just, I played the crap out of it throughout the holidays. And like, you know, it came out, I think, I want to say like mid-December, and adored it. And then I reviewed it and I gave it a 9.5. And I think it's one of the smartest, coolest episodic roguelike games I've ever played. And it came out on mobile earlier this year and I just bought it on mobile and then played through it again because it's incredible. And then I know they added a crap ton of more content to it that I have not really toyed with. When I played it on mobile, I basically just replayed things that I already played.
Yeah, I didn't realize it's a mobile version. I will probably pick that up there too. It's just such a good game.
It's only like
$5
too.
Yeah, well, right now it's on sale on Switch for like $2. Like, there's no excuse for people to pick this up. Yeah, it's like 85% off right now.
John, I don't know if you would like it or not, but just buy it because it rules.
It's so cheap. Okay. Just buy it. Yeah. I mean, I feel like I'm at the point with roguish games where I more often than not, I see that moniker, I see that genre, and I kind of do a double take or kind of roll my eyes a little bit. You know, like I've played so many of those and reviewed so many of those that I don't seek it out anymore. But Dicey Dungeons, I'd heard good things. I know Neil, you quite liked it in your review. And just any game that's kind of on sale for like 80%+ off that I've heard about.
There's a number of games that I came across recently that I'm like, oh, I got this because it was on a deep discount and I heard it was great.
Yeah, exactly.
I own Metro Last Light because it was like $2 on the eShop the other day. And I'm like, I have gold coins for that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's nice when if you're paying with gold coins and then also getting like a steep discount on top. To the point where these games are free, like it's hard not to just want to take a flyer on so many of them. But yeah, this is an easy one to pick up at $2. I think the sale ends early November, November 3rd, maybe. But yeah, so Dicey Dungeons, I picked it up after finishing Mario plus Rabbids. I wanted something kind of small, palate cleanser ish, and it did the job, and is continuing to do the job. So the premise is that you are these dice characters, and each one is a different kind of RPG type class, you know, like a warrior, a witch, a thief, things like that. And they all have different kind of special abilities that allow them to manipulate the dice you roll, and the dice that you roll function as your attacks and your abilities. You go through a dungeon consisting of six floors, with the sixth floor being a boss fight. Each character has six episodes that they can go through. You have to finish the earlier ones to access the later ones. And each time you do a different episode, there's new rules put in place. Like your starting equipment will be different, which means like you the dice you use will maybe have different attacks, or the items will have special abilities, like the ability to heal you or give you a shield or burn the opponent's dice so they can't use them without taking damage. But yeah, you're just trying to go through these six floors and level up by fighting as many of the enemies as you can. Collecting items from chests. Sometimes you can upgrade your equipment as well, make it stronger. But all these little things about it are so clever. The fact that you have like a grid where you can put your equipment, and it basically is a, how would you define it? Like a 2x3 grid with equipment taking up either one of those six slots or two of them.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you upgrade equipment, it'll change in size from a size 2 to a size 1. Allowing you more space in your inventory, the equipment that you are wearing, you have more space to put stuff in there. But yeah, man, it runs, you know, take like 10 to 15 minutes, something like that. So it's easy to play through a run, you know, and that's if you get further, right? Like sometimes the dice don't turn out your way, or you make a poor decision or something like that, and then your run gets stopped.
It's the way it deals with the episodic stuff too, where like, it's six characters, I think.
Six characters, five unlockable ones.
And they all have unique ability. Like there's a robot character that as you roll the dice, if you have a total dice roll of like, I think initially it's like if like throughout all your dice rolls, if it totals, it goes higher than 11, then you burn out and can't use your dice. But if you get 11 on the dot, you get a jackpot. And then there's a lot of other ways that throughout these different episodes that you play for each class, they tweak it a little bit. Like I believe there's like a fighter character that initially like you can get him to be very powerful, but then there's like a poison effect that then hits it, so that way you're always kind of worrying about your health decreasing. Or there's another one where I think you're well stocked at the beginning, but then have to give up a card or an item at the end of I think every battle or something ridiculous.
His second episode, it's like you mentioned, every time you level up, and you want to level up because you get more dice to throw and to use on abilities,
you get
every
higher
time
you level points
up,
and
his hit points, his max hit points goes down, so it's do you want to level up to the max or not? Like it's hard to choose,
and it's just every single episode has just like this different tweak that just recontextualizes how you have to think and proceed with playing the game, which is why I find it like, even when I'm doing like the same episode more than once, like depending on your layout, you could play it completely differently. And for when sure. you do land upon a build with really good synergies, it's just fun when you're like, oh, kind of lucked out that now I have like, you know, this thing that I need evens to power and this thing that I need odds to power. And then I can just use these in combination and like lay down a bunch of poison on an enemy and then have an attack that does it where like, oh, if they have five or more poison, it does three times the damage or something ridiculous like that. Mm-hmm. Like it's so rewarding when you do land upon such a dynamite synergy. And damn it, I'm going to probably go back to playing this game on my phone or my Switch soon.
Yeah, now that you've mentioned that it's on mobile, I have all this like Google credit saved up from doing these silly surveys. So I'm definitely going to pick that up for whatever price it is, frankly. But yeah, I love how all the characters feel different. Like they each time you play is a different one. You can do a different episode or you can just playing as a new character. It feels like you're playing the game differently enough that it's compelling. Like the thief, for example. With him, you almost want to roll low because more his abilities are generally his starting abilities or the items you pick up for him are yeah. lend themselves well to ones and twos and threes. And then other characters, you just want to brute force it. You want fours and fives and sixes. So you want abilities that let you pump up your dice or re-roll them if they're not high. So it's fun how they all have a unique quirk to them. And then the fact that their episodes change as well, you unlock more. You mentioned some DLC, so there's at least in the Switch version, there's two other kind of pieces of DLC that came with it when I bought it. One was like a Halloween themed one, which doesn't change it up too much. But there are three characters there with I don't know how many episodes they have, but at least three. And then there's another one as well, which is kind of the whole premise is that it's almost like a game show that they're on, right? And they're trying to mm-hmm. like win whatever their heart desires by going through these dungeons. The irony is that when you get to the end of an episode, you spin a wheel hoping to win your car or your money or whatever you want, and it always lands on like the skull, right? Which is nothing, and I guess they have to keep playing. The second set of DLC, it's like a reunion show, and so it starts off with all the dice characters like sitting in their chairs talking to Lady Luck, who is the host, and kind of interviewing them a little bit, like it's a reunion show on a reality TV show, right? So fun kind of premise that they're playing with there. And yeah, it's just like, man, it's charming, it's simple, but man, is it fun.
Yeah, I will. It is I do have enough gold coins to get it, but I could also get the night vision app for my Switch for that same price.
You really should be doing both, I think, John. You gotta
yeah, that's
to get
fair
both.
I could probably
yeah
you know just do something for me. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah,
one for me, one that's for right. you. But I mean, legitimately, like Dicey Dungeons is one of the best games on Switch. It's
yeah, so I think so too. I didn't realize. I looked at the Metacritic. It's got an 88 Metacritic, and I'm like, I'm not surprised. Like, it feels kind of hidden gem-ish, you know. And maybe that's because it came out at the end of the year in December, where sometimes games get lost in the shuffle, right? Of award season and holiday season and stuff like that. But man, this is one that it's worth the full price. It's a no brainer at $2.
Everybody was still playing Animal Crossing in December of 2020.
That's right. So. Yes, we were, sure.
Yeah, it is $5 on mobile.
Yeah, I'm going to buy it right now.
It's a very, very good, mobile port. Mm-hmm. And like, I don't know if it has touchscreen support on Switch, but it is a very effortless touchscreen game on mobile.
Cool. Well, real quick, before we move on to some news and some listener mail, I just wanted to call out that I was watching the Digital Foundry video on No Man's Sky, which huge fan of Digital Foundry. Those guys do just incredible stuff.
But less
of a but and more of an interesting note on perspective when it comes to Switch games. They did their video on No Man's Sky. I reviewed No Man's Sky for NWR. You can watch my video review or read it or however you like to consume your media. And my opinion was that this is a really insanely impressive port. My resolution counts had it running at 720p docked, which for a game like this is just outrageous. Reasonably steady performance, good image quality handheld. It has anti-aliasing, but not like so aggressive anti-aliasing that some indie Switch games use to hide that they're low resolution to the point that it creates all these artifacts. Like, just a very intelligently done port. And a lot of the visual weaknesses it had were things that it carried over from existing versions. But the Digital Foundry video on it wasn't like, oh, this is garbage, but it was very hard on the port and called out a lot of things that I mentioned in my review, as far as like there's some issues where like low resolution alpha effects, when you see geometry intersecting with an alpha effect, which can be like smoke or something like that, the edge of that geometry will appear to take on the resolution of the alpha effect, which can make it look lower resolution than it actually is, and stuff like that. And these are all issues that are in every version of the game. Like, that's if you play it on Xbox Series X, that's still there. It's less noticeable because you're working with a higher base resolution, but it's there. And so they were critiquing this. They were talking, like he mentioned, you know, like that it was disappointing how low resolution the volumetric clouds were, which I thought was very funny. And I just, it was an interesting moment of, like, I look at that game, and if somebody were to say, like, oh, well, the volumetric clouds are very low resolution, I look at it and I go, yeah, but it has volumetric clouds. Like, the disparity in power between the Switch and the other systems running this game is so huge that I feel like it's important when judging these games to really take that into account and be careful how your expectations are for the system, because it's just, given that Digital Foundry recently had to do a discussion about whether the Switch could even run volumetric clouds, like the fact that we're critiquing it for the clouds being too low resolution is just hilarious to me. But yeah, I guess my main comment is just that if you watched that video and are questioning whether or not you should pick up No Man's Sky on Switch, I mostly just wanted to offer a counter opinion that I think this is an exceptionally good port, and I was a little surprised with how it was being represented, given that things like, you know, Witcher 3 and Doom and Wolfenstein and all of these games that we consider just these miracle ports are running at significantly lower resolutions and are significantly more compromised. But we view those as like, oh, those are great. But this, I don't know about this. I thought it was an odd take, and nothing against Digital Foundry. Once again, I love their content. It was just it caught me off guard because it seemed very unlike them. Normally, they're very aware of that disparity between Switch and other platforms. But yeah. Anyway, if you follow Nintendo in the slightest, you may have heard recently, Helena Taylor, the original voice actress for Bayonetta 3, or Bayonetta, is not returning in Bayonetta 3. She put out several videos.
So the first video I get, this video makes sense. You know, there's the call for the boycott, like, all right. Then we start going through, like, the second and the third video. One of them's the one where she, like, does not name Jennifer Hale, but is basically like, that bitch can eat shit. And then when you get to the fourth video, she's just like talking about like a Bible story about Jesus and Lazarus and poor people, and keeps on referring to the corporate fat cats at Nintendo and Platinum Games.
Yes. Yeah, it gradually sort of descends.
And like, it's the thing where like, I think some of her overall points about, you know, getting paid what you're worth for what you think you're worth as a voice actor, as an actor. Like, I get that, and like, sure, more power to absolutely her in that regard. It does, like, the veers on performance art by the end of those four Twitter videos.
Yes. And the thing that has, you know, recently been added to the story, obviously her initial claim was that she was offered $4,000 for the entire project. And obviously that was insanely low, which it is. And when we heard that initially, we had some doubts about the accuracy, and we pointed out in our original news story that based on union rates for voice actors, of she's a member of the union for that number is like suspiciously low, and like there's a minimum amount you have to pay your voice actors per like hour, which I believe is $200, which would get them about 20 hours, which for a main character in a multiverse game where all of the characters are the main character seems like a very short amount of time to record all of her dialogue in. So we had some questions about the story and felt like we were missing some things. And yesterday, as of when we're recording this, came out from a piece by Jason Schreier at Bloomberg that doesn't appear that her version of the story, it might not be entirely accurate, and that it was in fact that she was offered $4,000 per session for a minimum of 5 sessions. So 4,000 suddenly becomes, what, 20,000? At least, possibly more if there wound up needing to be more sessions, which is up in the air whether or not you feel like that's too low for voice acting. But it's disappointing because it means that the entire discussion of pay for voice actors is sort of marred in this, like, oh, but it was under the premise of what appears to have probably been a lie, which is just, yeah, it's disappointing that that's how that went. Because I feel like there's probably a real conversation to be had, but like, it's buried now.
I mean, it's also like negotiation 101, where it's like, all right, we're gonna offer you like, you know, $25,000. It's, you know, higher than the union rates to do this. And she fires back and she's like, 6 figures in residuals.
Yes.
Which, so there's some stuff that I've heard about it, is that I think a lot of it stems from, I mean, whether or not she's right or wrong in this, I think is, you know, kind of up for debate. But I think in Helena Taylor's eyes is that the voice performance she gave for Bayonetta in Bayonetta 1 and 2 was a huge driver for the success of the overall games. And I think the appearance of Bayonetta in other things that I believe she probably did not get residuals on, I'm pretty sure.
Probably not for Smash, maybe the anime.
Yeah. But I think in terms of Smash Brothers, I don't think like anybody that's a voice actor in that game gets any kind of residuals, which that is honestly, taking a step back, that's garbage.
Yeah. But like, that's, especially considering how well that game sells too.
Well, yeah. My understanding with like residuals and percentages and things like that is oftentimes that's used in negotiation more in the context of, our thing is low budget, we can't afford to give you an initial large paycheck, but you can take this gamble, and then if it does well, you get more money.
Yeah, like that's what I think it was Donald cited, that one of the voice actors in Breath of the Wild said that they made more money voicing a character in Freedom Planet because they had residuals than they did voicing a character in Breath of the Wild, which I don't think anybody's arguing that. I think Nintendo across the board pays voice actors less than, I mean, maybe not less. It is within, I know Nintendo, I believe, used scab voice actors for some games a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. But like the rates that they pay are not super high.
Sure. But I will mention that I don't have the numbers to support this, but I would imagine that the base pay for Breath of the Wild versus Freedom Planet, like the initial payment,
is
probably much
so.
Higher. And like that was a gamble for that voice actor to take residuals as opposed to that initial lump payment.
And I think it's in general, going back to like why we're in this mess with, I feel like a lot of people have had eyes on, if they've been looking at it beyond the weird Twitter videos, is the reality of how, I guess depending on how you look at it, voice actors are either hideously overpaid or underpaid. Because I have seen a lot of takes out there that it's like, oh, $1,000 for like 2 hours work. Blah. But it's like, I think that's devaluing the work that an actor puts into a thing. And
to an extent, there is an argument to be made for it. Like, I think the median, the average yearly salary of an American household is like $55K.
Yeah.
So when you hear somebody making $20K in 5 days, it's like, fuck you for wanting more money. Like, I get that reaction. I totally understand it.
But it's also, the difference is that like I'm not like the fucking manager at a Kroger's versus the character in a smash hit Nintendo game. Like,
well, smash hit might be saying a bit much.
I meant more Smash Brothers.
Oh, but, haha. Yeah, and I'm not saying that those people are right.
Yeah.
But I completely understand the reaction.
Diving into this a little bit, it seems like I think it was around when Breath of the Wild came out. I want to say 2016, 2017 was when SAG-AFTRA, which is the Screen Actors Guild, something voice actors, I forget what AFTRA stands for, but the voice actors union struck. And a lot of that was about, like, they wanted to have residuals. They wanted to have better rates. Like, they wanted, it was, you know, better wages and things like that, which, you know, good on you. It seems like when they settled, they didn't really get that much, like, at least residuals specifically.
Yeah, what did they get?
It might have been like the rates might have gone up.
Yeah.
But I know the residuals point was something that they didn't really lose. And I think from talking to people more knowledgeable about the situation, I think a lot of it is that, like, the voice actors union is kind of a little bit more scattered when it comes to, like, whereas I think, like, Screen Actors Guild, the way they're worked into Hollywood and, you know, movies and TV is, I think it's more ingrained, whereas with voice acting and video games, it's a little bit more spread out. So it was, they couldn't get all these people to agree to fight this fight. So when it came down to it, you know, residuals were not a thing that they got, and the rates, well, maybe better, still were incredible, especially with the promise for residuals and some of these projects that make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. I think Bayonetta, you're barking up the wrong tree if you want to be voicing a character that's going to make you a lot of money in residuals, because
right.
I think what, like, did, I mean, first one, maybe a few million over multiple releases, maybe. And that's, yeah. You know, still, it's, I don't think Bayonetta is like a loss leader, but I don't think it's necessarily making bank.
It's not the game that I would triumphantly kick down the door and demand six figures and residuals on.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, there has been some stuff that's been referenced about, like, Grand Theft Auto voice actors trying to get residuals, and, like, as
that's
well
fair.
They should.
Yeah, that one's
you're
fair.
Like, I got 0.00001% for Grand Theft Auto 5, and I am a billionaire now. But it does, I mean, it's the union for the voice actors let them down, and that's why we saw this absurdity play out over the past week or so. You know, it's not to say, I mean, I'm with you if you want to say, like, you know, screw these corporations who won't pay people money, but also I don't really see, like, I'm of two minds with a lot of these things, where I want to, you know, support the people, support the workers, etc., but also I can put myself in the shoes of Nintendo or Platinum Games and look at the situation being like, well, if she's going to be like this, we can pay someone else to do the same voice and no one's going to really care. And unfortunately, they're right. No one really cares.
Well, and here's the, and this is not remotely a bash on her performance, but Bayonetta, the franchise, Call of Duty has more nuanced and subtly developed characters than
it's a good voice performance, but yeah, it's not like it's this, like, incredible story.
Right. Nobody's like the performance of Bayonetta was just, you know, life changing. It made me want to become an actor. Like, no. Like,
yeah.
She shows up, she says one liners in a British accent with a lot of innuendo. It's not a nuanced character. And your performance is great. Like, no dig on your performance, but, like, you're expendable. You're not Al Pacino in The Godfather. Like,
yeah,
you can be replaced with anybody else who can kind of do a British accent. Sorry.
It's almost a problem of video games in general, just being the result of so many different people's creative processes, right? Like, compared to, like, a movie or a TV show where there's no gameplay involved at all, right? Like, you're not manipulating those media with a controller or with a keyboard and mouse or something like that. There's so much more that can go into a game in terms of, you know, the creation and then the enjoyment of it, that what happens is the voice acting becomes a smaller piece of that pie, you know? Whereas in a cartoon show or an animated movie, it's a major piece, right? Like,
yeah.
It's just tough.
Yeah, and you're still very important, and, like, the work you're doing 100% is valid and critical to the game, but there is a tone in all of this of, like, when you come out and be like, well, I'm kind of, like, one of the big reasons this game sold well, and it's like, well, A, it didn't, and B, like, I don't know that that's true. Like, I think people liked it because it was really swooshy, swooshy, kicky, shooty.
I mean, if there was some proof like that, oh, let's say she voiced the first game and it sold well, and then the second game she didn't, and it didn't sell well, and people's chief complaint in the review is that the, you know, whoever they hired to play Bayonetta in Bayonetta 2 didn't sound right. Like, then maybe you have that proof of like, yes, I did contribute to the sales of the first game, and so you would expect, you know, maybe a stronger offer for her to be in the third game, something like that. But unfortunately, we just don't know. Like, we won't know until the third game comes out and people say, oh, we didn't like Jennifer Hale, her performance as much in Bayonetta. We want the original voice actress back. I don't know.
Well, and I mean, can either of you tell me the plots to either Bayonetta game?
There's like a Danny DeVito-esque character like shopping somewhere. There's a kid named Loki.
Okay.
That's more than I know.
Star Fox level.
Do you know what? Yeah. Okay. But exactly. Like, you, yes. The plot is not the plot. The story, the characters are just not, they're not it. And that's, once again, like, you can still want to get paid fairly, but kicking down the door for three figures in residuals is a bold fucking move.
Yeah.
Like, have the awareness to see what your game is before you make that move. There's totally a discussion to be had here, but it's amazing to me that she felt she had the cards to play this hand.
I think it'll be really interesting to see if and how all of this discussion, this discourse, will impact, or how it will impact the sales of the game. Like, are people going to boycott after her call for that, or are others going to be galvanized when they find out that, you know, her politics are not what other people agree with, right? Like,
that's a whole other thing.
Exactly. That's what I mean. Yeah. Like, there's so many little things going on, pieces of information being discovered, but at the center of it, you have this product that is, you know, I think a fair number of people are anticipating this game, and you look at the critical reception of these games, they're, you know, very, very high. But is it finally time for Bayonetta being on Switch, this new game on Switch, it's time to kind of, you know, have it stay in the sun, or is it going to have the Switch effect, the Switch bump, I guess, and get to, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 million or something? I don't know, but I wonder if any or all of
this
will
affect
that.
Yeah. I can't see it getting there, but
I'd be surprised if it outsold Dread, frankly.
We'll, I'd also say that, like, if you were going to not buy a Platinum Games game based on the moral fiber of someone who worked on it, like, what have you been doing this whole time? Like, that's like, that the people in charge of that company have always very loudly been horrible people. So if that was going
to
stop,
John,
you from buying it,
we're gonna,
like,
start
it's
now.
Too late. It's, yeah, you better go look at those multiple copies of Bayonetta, Bayonetta 2, Astral Chain, Star Fox Assault, or Star Fox Zero.
I didn't buy Astral Chain because it's a weird cop game.
Yeah, but you're a cop in booty shorts, which makes it somewhat
better. I mean,
you're a
cop in booty shorts beating the shit out of animals, so...
Demons from a cyber dimension. And if it makes you feel better, you've also enslaved one of them.
Yeah,
so
okay, that, yeah, that was
that kind of, you know...
You enslave the animals.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Speaking of games that I have no recollect... I reviewed that game, and I have no idea what the plot of that game was. It just sort of happened and looked neat.
How was the voice acting?
Couldn't tell you. Couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
Hopefully they didn't pay too much for it.
I think we know they didn't.
Right.
Well, we can assume they didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, yeah, safe assumption.
Unless they did, and it was like, oh, we're not making this mistake again.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's like Nolan North voices the dog.
That's right.
Blew all their money.
I mean,
on,
the demon,
yeah,
dog. The slave demon dog.
Yeah.
There is a regular dog. You get a costume and can run around as the regular dog. But to wrap up here, we have an ambitious piece of listener mail from our old pal James.
Yeah,
T.
I'm gonna take a nap. Wake me up when you're done reading.
Yeah, I'll start reading this, and I'll ping you guys when I'm done.
Neil can watch another episode of The Patient.
Yeah,
get caught up right there, and
see Steve Carell be very serious.
We're legally required to cover it because he talked about Star Fox. He says, "Good morning, gents. It's nighttime when we're recording this, but I'll let that slide. I'm sending you the follow-up to my Star Fox Adventure email from a year or so ago. I recently went on a retro kick and picked up some GameCube games that I wanted, but was in college at the time and never got, due to limited money. Assault, as in Star Fox Assault, is one of them. I had a friend who had it, and we enjoyed the multiplayer on downtime between rounds of Halo 2, but I never got it myself. Having played through the campaign, I have to say, I loved it. I know at the time people criticized the on-foot parts, but I didn't think they were too bad. Also, the traditional Star Fox rail shooter parts are still incredible. Since Assault, the series has floundered. Zero may have killed it. I got Zero right after I got married, and I can say that trying to play that co-op was so bad, it nearly ruined my new marriage. I recently got Command and can understand why some people might like it, but personally, I hate it. Both of these just feel like the unnecessary changes for the sake of the gimmick controls. So what does one do with Star Fox? This is my thought. Circling back to Halo, Halo became big because of its combat sandbox. I realize Assault was trying something similar with the missions, where you switch from foot to Landmaster to R-Wing. It's a bit dated and rough, but a cool idea. This is what I think they should do with Star Fox. Essentially the campaign mode of Halo Infinite. Take Star Fox and create 4 or 6 open areas you can attack from any vehicle or on foot with main parts and bonus content. Nintendo has done well with open world, Breath of the Wild, and Arceus. Why not turn Star Fox into an open world combat sandbox a la Halo Infinite? What do you think of this idea? And also, do you agree Assault is vastly underappreciated? Shoot, forgot to mention The soundtrack is also absolutely gorgeous, and how Star Fox music needs more love. Boy, there's a lot of stuff there. But yes, Star Fox Assault is good.
I love Star Fox Assault.
I don't know. I know you'll hate me to say it. I don't know if I've ever played it, frankly. GameCube just wasn't a big console for me. And so
that's it's fair.
A lot of blind spots on that console. Like, I played the Rogue Leader games. Like, does that count?
It's kind of close.
Yeah, probably as close as I got.
But yeah, no, I think it was great. It came out like Star Fox Assault, I think, to your point of it coming out after Adventures and like how Command and Zero really changed it up. Like, Star Fox Assault was very much a course correction after Adventures. Like, that was them trying to do very traditional Star Fox. And comically, like, they kind of didn't. Like, they went back to like the rail shooter stuff. A lot of the on foot stuff we now can see is like very clearly taken from Star Fox 2. Like, a lot of that level structure is very directly from that. But yeah, people didn't like it at the time, I think, mostly. But like, the thing about Star Fox is that everybody thinks they want Star Fox 64 again, but they simultaneously do and they don't. Like Star Fox Assault, I feel like, is a legitimately good evolution of a lot of those ideas, and people hated it for still not quite being like Star Fox Assault. And then Star Fox Zero is just Star Fox 64 again, and people hated it for being Star Fox 64 again, but with controls they didn't like, because...
I mean, well, no, because if they put a headset on your head and it was Star Fox Zero, they'd be like, this is amazing!
Right.
Revolutionary! This'll take off! And instead, because you had to move a gamepad around, and it wasn't strapped to your head.
That's not a diss on you for not liking it. I just honestly have never been able to figure out why the controls are so hard in that game.
I mean, we had that experience where at the E3 where Star Fox Zero was rolled out, like, you and I played that demo and it just clicked with both of us.
Yeah, like, it just wasn't, we didn't have a problem.
It's one of those things where, like, I just don't understand where people are coming from.
Yeah,
because it's also the kind of thing where I played Star Fox Zero, and when I was playing it, that was around the time that, like, I first tried, I don't know if it was like the Rift or PSVR or whatever, but it was around that, I think it was at that PAX East that Star Fox Zero came out, like, when we were at PAX East, and I played VR games, and I'm like, oh, this is kind of like Star Fox Zero, but strapped to my head. And then seeing people react to Star Fox Zero was so confusing, because I'm like, but everybody's talking about how cool VR is right now. How come, like Nintendo kind of made a VR thing, but you don't need a headset for it?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, yeah, if the controls don't click with you, they don't click with you. But if VR clicks with you and Star Fox Zero doesn't, then I'm very confused.
Yes. Yeah, there's a disconnect there that I've never quite been able to follow. Yeah.
I like Star Fox Zero. It's fun.
Yeah, I like it too. I like Star Fox Assault. I also like Star Fox Command, but Command is one where I get it if you don't like
Command
it.
I didn't like initially. It took me a while to kind of get it because it is,
yeah,
it's a weird game. I think it's a very interesting and unique game, but it's a weird game.
I have a soft spot for Command now after doing the documentary and like digging way too deep into Command. So now I'm like, I love Command, but I can see where that one wouldn't work for people.
Did they release Command on the Wii U as a DS game?
Yeah. Yeah. Command is on Wii U. That's the last time I played it. I played it on Wii U.
The last time you will ever play it, because they'll never make another two screen system. The Switch ruined it. But as for your what to do with Star Fox, this isn't that far off from, I did a video a while back called what's next for Star Fox or something. We did kind of a series of them with various games. And this isn't too far off from what we talked about in that, which was essentially, do kind of an open world space game with planets and stuff and let people fight enemies in an open world type environment, but then like pick up a mission and that mission might set you on a rail line course or something like that, which I do think is a lot of what Halo Infinite does and why, you know, I don't know that it's totally accurate to call Halo Infinite an open world, because what that game does really well is rather than being just an open world game, it's a Halo game with an open world connecting all the levels. So like most, like there's a full Halo game worth of linear hallway shooters, like the classic Halo gameplay within Halo Infinite, but you traverse an open world to get to those. And then once you get into them, it's like, it's this bespoke contained level. And I agree that something like that with Star Fox, where you traverse an open world to get to a quote unquote traditional Star Fox level, would work very well. I do think that Star Fox is in the awkward point right now of like, I don't know, like even if Nintendo made a really good Star Fox at this point, I think the general market perception of Star Fox is kind of bad right now. And I don't know that it would have the chance to do well. Maybe the Switch bump would make it happen, but I almost feel like it needs to kind of do the Metroid thing and disappear for a while and then come back once the nostalgia is strong. But we'll see. And yes, also the music is great because it's like an actual orchestra. Do you guys have any additional thoughts on Star Fox Assault?
I realized I can play Star Fox Assault in on the Steam Deck, and I might do that.
You should.
Yeah.
It's good. I have it on my Xbox, which is the last place that I played it.
If and when I get a Steam Deck, I would definitely try it out because it's I guess it's one of my only Star Fox blind spots. I've played every other game.
There's definitely some, I mean, it's the fact that like on foot controls like you're in a vehicle. Like that's weird.
So I've learned that this is a thing that people oftentimes don't know about that game. But when you start a game, you can go into the control options and give yourself totally normal dual analog controls for the on foot segments if you want. Can set up individual control schemes for each on foot vehicle.
You can do it for each one. Okay.
Yep. Yeah.
I'm going off of memories of a long time ago, so it could be something that either I forgot or skipped over.
Well,
Okay. In the beginning, I know they give you the option of because that was when Twin Stick was still kind of a novelty.
By default, it controls hilariously. The on foot stuff controls hilariously similar to Metroid Prime, where you like hold down a trigger to aim and like rotate, and it's just a bad time. You can just set it to a more modern control scheme and it plays better.
Like, and I think like the story in Assault is one of the best in the series.
It does a good job of like, it's well presented. It doesn't have the branching paths.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It's a well, and in fairness, everything from where Star Fox 64 kind of rebooted the first one from Star Fox 64 up until
Two
Command,
Adventures, then Assault, then
it's
Command.
It's a linear. Yeah. Like, Adventures, the plot of that happens after 64, then Assault, then Command. Like, they are a linear continuing plot, which is not something we do with Star Fox anymore.
And it was just cool to like see a Star Fox game where the villain wasn't just Andross.
Yeah, and there's no plot twist that makes it Andross.
Yeah. And you do have because Andrew Andrew Oinkenos is like the boss in the first level, and then it's the Aperoids.
Yeah, well, and he has like a mech that kind of looks like Andross, and the Aperoids destroy it, which is a very clear, like, the game is telling you, like, nope, we're done. There will be no secret Andross reveal in this game. We're killing it.
What a good game. Yeah, I'm gonna have to play through it sometime soon.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And the multiplayer is incredible. And I would pay, if Nintendo just released the multiplayer as an online game on Switch, I would pay $60 just for that. You wouldn't even have to include the base game.
Honestly, the multiplayer is the kind of thing that I have the same memories of that as I have, like, messing around with, what is it, Jedi Knight 2 and Jedi Knight Academy, the ones that have the online, where it wasn't even so much the, like, oh, like, this is such a smooth, great experience. It was like, I could just mess around in this world.
Yes, well, it's like you say in your email, it's a sandbox. Like, it very much has that appeal to it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, it is like the fact that, like, in the multiplayer, like, you can get in ships and fly around and try to pick the other person up. Like, oh, it's so
well, and so it even goofy. Like, it even, like, you know, if you get in a ship and somebody else playing hops onto the wing of your ship and you take off, they'll stay on your wing.
Yep.
Like, there's so much room for just, like, experimenting and mixing things together. And yeah, it's got a little bit of that chemistry to it.
I feel like there's been, like, there was a branching paths, if you will, like a Star Fox game of, I mean, I just have the memories of an, you know, I guess, like, early 2000s of, yeah, I would have the competitive multiplayer games, you know, Mario Kart got Cutthroat and everything. But, like, I have a lot of memories of playing, like, Assault, Jedi Knight 2, and Halo 2, as it wasn't even so much of, like, who can get the most kills. It was just, like, what dumb stuff can we do with the tanks?
Of course.
What can we do with this ghost, this warthog? And I feel like probably sometime, you know, late, you know, Xbox 360 era, there was the paths of where, like, you branched into the Minecraft things where it was, like, oops, all messing around. And then you went right to Call of Duty 4, and it was like, now every online multiplayer game is hyper competitive. And it is, I mean, I think that, you know, kind of going back to our brief comments about Splatoon 3, I think that's where I'm at with Splatoon 3, is that I know it's probably a little bit more me than the game, but what I really liked about Splatoon 1 was that it was that play space. And now with Splatoon 3, I think it's partially because of what I want out of the game and the fact that it is now the third entry in a series that's been around for almost a decade. I'm sorry, like, having people wag their fingers in front of me because I'm not playing the right way. Like, this was fun on Wii U when I could just, like, explore and play the game and not have people, like not have memes be about, like, oh, paint your base. It just kind of, like, you're not, it's not, it's a competition, it's not fun.
Yeah, a different take on how that stuff should work.
Yeah, what I'm saying is I want vehicles in Splatoon 4 and make it like Star Fox Assault.
I would like vehicles in Splatoon 3. I'd like literally anything new in that game.
You guys will get one new boss in Salmon Run. They're going to restrict the hours again to punish you for not buying Splatoon 3. It'll be only 4 hours a week.
They're
going to
restrict the hours for all multiplayer, not just Salmon Run.
Yes, that's
in fact, the game will only boot at certain times.
I forget the name of it. That weird grappling hook thing. The shit that you can do with that is incredible in Splatoon 3. Because there's like a grappling hook power up for one of the, like, I guess it's some of the weapons that you can just basically, like, ninja around the entire map if you get really good at it. There's some play there. It's just like, I don't know, everybody stop being so, like just have fun. Turf War is a joke.
Yeah. Anyway, remaster Star Fox Assault. You're good buddies with Bandai Namco these days. Make it happen. And with that, I think we'll call it an episode. So thank you both very much for joining me. If you are listening to this in a format where you can leave it a review, that would be a super cool thing for you to do. You can send us emails about what GameCube games you're checking up on to connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. You can follow us on Twitter @connectivitynwr. And yeah, I think that's all the things. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Oh, and play Wind Waker. We'll be right back. This was made possible by our generous supporters on Patreon. Check out patreon.com/NWR for all the details.